Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us.
Hi, Rose. Welcome to What to Read Next podcast.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for having me.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am an author of historical romance, and I also now have written a gothic as well. You can find me at roselearner.com and my books. And I also am a freelance book editor and book doctor and research assistant at rosedoesthesearch.com.
I love this. So what was your romance journey?
That's a great question. I mean, when I look back at, like, even as a kid, you know, in like the sort of series, like say I was reading the Betsy Tacy books or something, like my favorite book was always the one where they grew up and had a romance. Mm-hmm. So I guess I always liked romance, but I first started reading like genre romance probably in like middle school. Mm-hmm. My middle school had this program called mentorship, where you told them what you wanted to be when you grew up, and then they like found somebody local who did that, who would like talk to you about what it was like and stuff. And I guess I must have, like, I don't remember thinking that I could be a professional writer, but I clearly told them I wanted to be a writer because they found a writer to be my mentor. Yeah, she was lovely. And she knew somebody who was a professional writer, like had made a living as a professional writer. And it was Carola Dunn, who wrote Regency Romance at the time. I think she's writing mysteries now. I'm not sure. I haven't looked in the last couple of years. But so I checked them out from the library and was immediately like completely sold.
So what was your journey to, what made you decide to write historical romance, you know, as opposed to other genres?
It's just what I've always written. Like I don't, or at least what I've always been drawn to. I mean, like even as a kid, a lot of my favorite books were historical. Like, I was obsessed with this book, Rebecca's War, about this like 14-year-old girl in Philadelphia during the British occupation, during the Revolutionary War, and this aristocratic British officer is wounded and billeted in her house, and they have this sort of like vaguely antagonistic, but like really they like each other sort of friendship / flirtation. And I was like obsessed with it. So I've just always loved reading it. And so I guess I just naturally started writing it as well.
So what's the process of writing historical romance? And then let's talk about gothics. What are some of the differences?
So some of the differences I would say is that a gothic some gothics are romances and some aren't. The one that I wrote, I mean, I would say that it is definitely the couple. I mean, the couple end up together. It's not quite as neat an ending as some of my romances, like my just historical Regencies. But I would say that a romance reader would be happy with the ending. I'm happy with the ending, but it's not as sort of, everything isn't quite as in a neat bow. Mm-hmm. A gothic, and some gothics don't have happy endings. Like some gothics, you know, might end in tragedy or whatever. But I would say the biggest difference between like, just if we're just saying gothic romance, is that a gothic romance is like darker and sort of leaves you a little bit more like unsettled, maybe. Like it's sort of edging towards horror. But in the sort of like haunted house, like psychological thriller, like, you know, Gaslight, Jane Eyre, like that kind of horror rather than like a slasher movie, kind of horror. Yeah.
Yeah. I love this. Yeah. It's something I've been diving into slowly but surely. Thanks to this podcast, I've got some recommendations and I read a few of them and I like the genre. It's just like, I feel like it's not as widely, you know, available as other historical romance, as other, you know, subgenres. So do you have any
recommendations? Yeah, it had a big flowering in like the 70s, I would say. And it also, it was, you know, it had a really big flowering in the 1790s, was sort of the original, like the 1780s, but especially 90s. I think we're going to see an uptick of it. I mean, we'll see, but I do feel like I've started to see at least more romantic suspense, and like specifically more like romance authors, like writing slightly darker stories that have a more like for example, Victoria Dahl, it's pen name Victoria Helen Stone. And she's been writing sort of more, I don't know what genre she would necessarily say they are like, but sort of more like towards that gothic. I think there are people that kind of, because there is so much, like you see gothics become popular at times where there's a lot of sort of like turmoil and like fear. And I think we are in a period like that now. So like people are kind of craving that catharsis of like feeling like really experiencing the dread that they're living with, like fully without it being like dangerous for them to do that, and then sort of being able to process it in that. Does that make sense at all? I don't know.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think it's like cyclical and I think it's like different periods. And so we are seeing some, you know, some books are gothics or some books are, you know, they're coming in and, you know, so I'm assuming in the next few years we'll see more of them. Yeah. So let's talk about The Wife in the Attic. So this is a queer Jane Eyre retelling. What was the inspiration? Like, what led you to write the story?
So it started out actually not like, well, I don't remember when I kind of realized that it was Jane Eyre. I first got the idea. So I, in one of my earlier books, All or Nothing, I'm like, I always hesitate because it's like, on the one hand, I don't want to give too much away about the plot because suspense is such a part. But on the other hand, I sort of feel like, you know, a lot of people are going to guess a fair amount based on the premise. So I don't know how much it really is giving away, but I wrote this book All or Nothing several years ago about, it's like a much sort of lighter, frothier novella about a like shy architect. And he is in love with this woman who like is a gaming den hostess. And so he like keeps like going to this, you know, she runs like a little casino kind of in her apartment with her best friend. And he keeps like going, even though he doesn't really, he's like an introvert and he doesn't enjoy it, you know? And then it ends up that he asks her to pretend to be his mistress at this house party so that he can like hide in his room and do work and people won't bother him. So, but while they're there, he's, you know, doing work and, you know, she's pretending that she's his mistress or whatever. So she's reading. And I was picking a book for her to read. And I remember my mother had this book that was called like, I don't remember what the name, it was like Jews in the Literature of England or something. And it was like a survey of like fiction that references Jewish people in English literature. And from like the 70s, like it had like the most ridiculous cover. Like it was like this shade of like orange red that was like the most like 70s thing. But it referenced this novel by Maria Edgeworth, who was another novelist kind of around the same time as like Jane Austen and, you know, Fanny Burney, like those Regency novelists. And she wrote this book, Castle Rackrent, which is sort of a like funny saga, family saga. But one of the stories in it is about this guy and he is keeping like his Jewish wife locked in her room to try to take her property and feeding, like forcing her to eat pork. And there's this, the part that is like the most chilling is that this is all from the point of view of this servant who like doesn't really have the full story, but he remembers that his boss told him that when they were dating, he would call her my pretty Jessica, which is like a reference to Merchant of Venice, the Shakespeare play where there's like an interfaith romance. Mm-hmm. And the Jewish girl is called Jessica. And it like that detail was like really stuck with me, where it was like, you know, that is, I feel like, the heart of so many Gothics, of like, this man seems like he cares about me, mm-hmm. but like, can I trust him? Because he could turn on a dime. Like people who seem like they care about you could turn on a dime. And like that really stuck with me. And then I was thinking about like, what if there was a governess, right? What if it's sort of a scenario like this, but then like a governess comes to the house and realizes mm-hmm. what's going on. So that was the inspiration for the book.
I love this. And it's an Audible original. So what was the process to get this become, is it audio first and then the book comes out, or is it just?
Yeah, it's audio exclusive for 6 months.
Okay. So yeah.
In all honesty, I had already written quite a lot of it when mm-hmm. it sold to Audible, and they ended up deciding to do, you know, sometimes with some of the Audible originals are a bit more sort of toward the almost like a radio play where there's sort of multiple actors and like sound effects and stuff like that. And then some are more sort of a straightforward audiobook. Mm-hmm. And because they ended up deciding to go as more of a straightforward audiobook with this one, that was a better fit for the story. I didn't do as much modification as I might have otherwise, because mm-hmm. it already was kind of, you know, I mean, it was pretty,
yeah,
it was already a pretty good fit. Yeah. The main thing that I did was actually, you know, and me and my editor talked quite a bit about like what kinds of sound production we might do, and like, do, you know, I think it ends up that there's going to be like some musical stuff in it because the book has a lot of music in it, but like primarily it's a straightforward audiobook, but we did talk about that stuff. But primarily what I ended up actually doing was going through and seeing if there were places where it didn't make sense to explain something that would be clear from the performance, mm-hmm. right? Like, so, like if it said, like she said quietly, right? Like in a book, you need to say that she said it quietly, but in an audiobook, the narrator is just going to say it quietly. So you don't need that. And so some of that stuff I sort of changed into stage directions.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm fascinated how this process goes about. And, you know, because it's interesting to think about a book that's going to be audio first, and the quality that takes you, like what is going to engage the audience to listen to the book, you know?
Yeah. And I do think that like, I was really pleased, like this is my first audiobook, so I'm really excited. I've wanted one for so long. And I think that the spooky, like that being my spookier book is going to be a really fun, because I feel like that lends itself so well to audio, both because like it can be so creepy, but also because like when you're reading, if you're reading a book and it's like suspenseful and you want to know what's like, you can kind of read faster, mm-hmm. right? Whereas like an audiobook, it's like it goes at the pace that it goes and you have to wait. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is like such a good fit for like sort of a slowly building suspense story, yeah. because like you just are like, you just have to like listen and like, you know, go at the pace that the book is taking you.
Yes, I agree. And speaking of Jane Eyre and Charlotte Bronte, you have some thoughts about her. Tell us a little bit about what are some of your thoughts about Charlotte Bronte?
I guess I have a lot of thoughts about Charlotte Bronte, but I feel like, I mean, I love Jane Eyre, honestly. Mm-hmm. I it's obvious, you know, I don't know how I would feel about it if I read it for the first time now. But I read it for the first time when I was like 10 or 11. I think my mom read it to me and I just fell in love with it. And I still, like, I have reread it a lot of times, mm-hmm. and I still love it, you know? And I even love Mr. Rochester, and I even ship Jane and Mr. Rochester. And I know that some, like a lot of people don't. A lot of people also do, but like, I think some people have kind of assume that because in this story, the first Mrs. Rochester is the love interest and not Mr. Rochester, that it's because I kind of hate Mr. Rochester. And I honestly don't. And I never quite know, like, it's like, I don't want to be like a lot of times it's like, they're excited to talk to somebody else that like, doesn't like Mr. Rochester. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, not like, I didn't mean to like lead you on, but, no. But I do, I think for me, like the thing with Jane Eyre that is so, that lends itself to this kind of thing is that the whole book is from Jane's perspective, mm-hmm. right? Like we don't see Mr. Rochester's point of view, which is another difference, I think, between a lot of modern romance and Gothic is that Gothic tends to be single point of view. Like mm-hmm. you only get the heroine's point of view, whereas like modern romances are typically alternating between the two or three love interests or mm-hmm. main characters. So like Mr. Rochester, if you look at the original Jane Eyre, and not everyone will agree with me, but I feel like if you take what Mr. Rochester says at face value and you believe him, he hasn't really done anything unforgivable to his wife. Like you might say it's unforgivable of him to lie to Jane about it, but like, I mean, she doesn't think so, right? But like his decision to keep his wife in the attic is defensible from his point of view because he doesn't have a lot of alternatives. Like she is, you know, according to him, again, psychotic, and he doesn't want to put her in an institution because they are scary and terrible, which I think is a pretty defensible position. So, you know, but that is if you believe what he says. And like, we don't have any way of knowing if what he says is true. So if he's lying, he could have done anything to his wife. And that I feel like is like not just the core of the Gothic, but like almost the core of like human experience, that like there is so much in life and in relationships that you have to take on trust. And like when you don't know if like you can never really know like what is going on with another person because you can't read minds, right? And so it's like, mm-hmm. you have to take things on trust. And like, there is this fundamental fear that you cannot trust.
Mm-hmm.
Or yeah. perhaps there's an experience of having trusted and been wrong. And so I think that is a really powerful kind of like human experience that I really love getting to kind of dive into and like swim around in.
I love this. Yeah. I really love, you know, diving into something and thinking about deeper and themes and the things that we see and we don't see and just going, you know, make sense of it, yeah. And I think even as you read it more often, you read it a couple times or even thousands of times, you still discover new things from the book, so
yeah. And you know, I'm gonna put in a word for Helen Burns and the queer romance that is already in Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. I do think that Charlotte Bronte was queer. Mm-hmm. She had a best friend, Ellen. I don't know how to pronounce her name. It's either, it looks like Nessie. It could be Nussie. But I think that they were girlfriends. Mm-hmm. There's like letters between them that seem very like sexy to me. Mm-hmm. And Charlotte Bronte's work, I've only read I think Jane Eyre and then one other novel, but the like Jane Eyre like feels queer to me. I mean, just mm-hmm. sort of subjectively, like, but also the friendship with Helen Burns I think is romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's specifically, there's this part where it talks about them going to the forest and they pick primroses or they sit on beds of there's something about primroses. And like, as an adult, I realized like from other research that primrose was like, is like a sex flower in, like it's a metaphor for sex in like poetry and folk songs.
Oh.
Like, so there's like that expression of like treading the primrose path.
Yeah.
And then there's also like, there's a folk song I know where the, it describes the girl going into the garden and plucking the primrose
mm-hmm.
and then she becomes pregnant. She fills her, the more she plucked, the more she pulled until she got her apron full, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like this double meaning of she's picking primroses and filling her apron, you know, putting them in her apron. And then like your apron being full is a way in folk songs that often it means pregnant, like you've got a baby under your apron and it's like puffing out your apron. So at that, I'm just going to put in a word for Helen Burns. And then I read another novel by Charlotte Bronte called The Professor that I also mm-hmm. thought was quite, quite queer.
I love this. I love you have a stand on it. So you have many thoughts. So this topic came from Sarah Wendell, and I'm actually really curious because when she brought it up, she was like, girls can talk about this. And so what are the things you've learned about writing romance from going to therapy and reading self-help books?
Well, I do feel like just sort of as a general thing, you know, anything that you learn about yourself or about the human experience, like when you write romance in it goes, right? Because mm-hmm. so much about writing romance is about like people processing their emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. So, but like one great example that I love, and I share it with my clients all the time. My therapist gave me this diagram, and it's like it's like kind of both how to think about your feelings, but also how to talk about your feelings so that other people understand them. Mm-hmm. And it's this like flow chart, and it's like it shows like your pre-existing vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. And then an event happens that is like filtered through the pre-existing vulnerabilities, right? Into your interpretation of the event, which then leads to physical changes that you might have because of your emotion, which then leads to thoughts mm-hmm. that you might have, and then leads to like your actions, right? Which might then lead to more emotions or whatever. So like, for example, suppose me and my partner have a deal that my partner is going to do the dishes, right? Mm-hmm. So my pre-existing vulnerability might be that in my house growing up, my parents were always fighting about doing the dishes, and my father never wanted to help my mother in the kitchen because that was like woman's work. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people are going to recognize the bare bones of this. I'm like wildly exaggerating for the example. Although I've learned from listening to the Judge John Hodgman podcast that like the source of all domestic disputes is how to load the dishwasher. So clearly a lot of people, but so then if we have this agreement that my partner is going to do the dishes and they don't do the dishes, right? Maybe I feel like this means that they don't care about me or respect my work. And then I become angry, and then my heart races, and then I glare at them, and then I yell at them, and then I feel guilty, right? You see? And so it's like, or if I wanted to talk to somebody about my emotion. So one of the ways that this is used in therapy might be, it would be in couples counseling, that like, if I were going to then talk to my partner mm-hmm. about this feeling, instead of being like, you don't love me because you didn't do the dishes and you're always mean and you don't value me, I might say, you know, this is like a fraught thing for me because like my father didn't do the dishes and I felt that it was like a lack of respect. So like when you didn't do the dishes, like it got my heart racing, right? And so it's this like sort of judgment-free way to think about feelings that mm-hmm. enables, like kind of opens up what's really happening. Mm-hmm. And this is so useful for writing, like, because when you want the reader to like, you know, if I was writing a scene in a book where the characters were going to have a fight because like one of them didn't do the dishes, if I just have one of the characters walk in and be like, can I swear? I don't know. What's your policy?
Yeah.
And is like, just like, fuck you. You didn't do the dishes. Like, you're sleeping on the couch tonight. The reader might, if they didn't have any context, might be like, whoa, like what's up with that? You know, that was a huge overreaction. Mm-hmm. Whereas like if I've set up the pre-existing vulnerabilities ahead of time, like maybe I'd had a scene earlier where the character like went home for dinner and her parents were fighting over doing the dishes and her dad was being mean, right? Mm-hmm. Then when I get to that scene where the character like walks into the kitchen and sees the dirty dishes, the reader immediately understands mm-hmm. mm-hmm. why they're upset. And so like when they react, I mean, maybe I still wouldn't want them to get like be like so aggressive unless there was other things going on, right? Like, but it's like when the character has that strong reaction, you want to have laid the groundwork so that, and then also in the moment explain like, she walked into the kitchen and saw the dirty dishes and the scene at home last night came back to her and the mean tone in her father's voice, her heart raced and she turned, right? And so it's like, now the reader completely can follow along and experience that emotion like with the character mm-hmm. instead of being confused or having to have it explained to them afterwards or like, you know, not being able to kind of connect in that way.
Yeah, I love thinking of how, like, you know, thinking about the emotions and the feelings and then, you know, seeing how the story can progress. Like, you build it upon each other. And so this takes work to just understanding what the emotions, what the triggers, what the family history, what, you know, all just different aspects of, you know, the character that can explain why they react the way they do. You know,
yeah. One writer I feel like is so good at this is Alyssa Cole. Have you read her stuff?
Yes, I have. She's great.
She is so good at setting up like the childhood stuff mm-hmm. that then like feeds into like what's going on in the present and like kind of taking you along so that like you aren't like can really like you like feel that like clench in your like mm-hmm. chest or your gut when like something happens that upsets the character because you just like. You know why they're upset and like you feel it. I love it so much.
Oh, that's yes. I love, yeah, I can see her writing really, really informing us the whole process of this character, you know. So I love this. So let's see, let's talk some book recommendations. What has been a book that you have read over the past few years that you can't stop gushing about?
Oh my gosh, there are so many. I just finished, speaking of Alyssa Cole, I just finished How to Catch a Queen, which is her latest, and I loved it so much. But I think my favorite of hers, I think it came out in the last years. I have no sense of time. A Prince on Paper. Have you read that one?
Yes, I have. It's so cool.
I'm obsessed with that book. I like literally started like a group chat on Twitter because I like needed, I was like reading it for like the third time and I needed to like...
I love that.
Tell people about my feels. Oh my gosh, I'm so bad at this. I really love Alicia Rye. I feel like I love the one with the tattoo artist so much. The is that Hate to Want You?
I think it's from that series. Yes, Hate to Want You. It's the one where she's a tattoo artist and you're not supposed to.
And they've been meeting secretly.
Yeah.
It's like a Romeo and Juliet sort of thing. Yeah. But it was like the first one in the series, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Love that one. I am obsessed. I'm so excited. I've loved everything by Kate Claiborne that mm-hmm. I've read. I feel like, I love Love Lettering so much. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited for the sequel. I just pre-ordered it. But my favorite of hers might actually be the one with Kit. I'm so bad with titles. It was one of the ones with like Luck in the name. Mm-hmm. And it was the first one. I want to say the hero's name was like Alex, maybe. No, yeah, Alex is Kit's brother.
I think it's Beginner's Luck. It's the one where
that sounds right. Yeah,
they win the
lottery. He's like a scientist.
That's the same. Like the STEM one.
Trying to recruit. Okay, yeah. Love that book. He's like trying to recruit her, and then his father has this like junk shop. Like everything about that book was perfection.
Laura here from the future. So as a special treat, Rose was able to give us a little tidbit of her upcoming book, The Wife in the Attic. So I'm just going to show you a little a clip about it so you can bring it in. It's an Audible Plus exclusive original. So you can download it if you have Audible Plus or if you have Audible membership. So let's just get to the clip.
A door shut softly. I gasped. Be rational. That was no cause for alarm. The house had other inhabitants. The door had not been one of mine. That left Clarissa's closet or the nursery door onto the landing. A floorboard creaked on the landing. Sir Kit, then. come to visit his sleeping daughter. The riddle was solved. So why did my mind keep turning it over? I was no better than a mouse myself. No candle, I realized suddenly. No flickering glow through the crack under my door. Sir Kitten wouldn't climb the stairs without a light, would he? My key was still in my hand. I rushed to the other door and opened it. Who's there? Footsteps raced down the stairs. I ran to the mouth of the stairwell in time to glimpse a shadowy figure disappear around the first bend, trailed by long hair? A cloak? I pounded after it, but inky darkness swallowed me whole at the first turn. My heel slipped from the narrow end of a spiraling step. I nearly tumbled into the abyss, the wall scraping my palms and a hard stone edge slamming into my shin.
I hope you enjoyed this little taste of this book, The Wife in the Attic, which is available in Audible Plus original. You can download it today. Now let's go to the rest of the interview.
So tell us where we can find you online.
My website is roselerner.com, and that's R-O-S-E-L-E-R-N-E-R. And that'll link you to everything. But as far as social media, I'm most active on Twitter, which is at roselerner. I do have my freelance website for, like, if you want to hire me as an editor or a research assistant, is rosedoestheresearch.com. And then my Patreon is also roselerner.
Awesome. Thank you, Rose, for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, rate, and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Want to connect with fellow romance readers and make new friends, get weekly book recommendations, attend monthly meetups, then join our Patreon community. You can join at whatreadnextblog.com/Patreon. Romance lovers, check out Queen Bee Reads Etsy shop for cute and comfortable bookish apparel. The shop also features social justice apparel and fun items from some of your favorite TV shows like The Schitt's Creek and The Office. Use code WHATTORead10 to save. Visit whatreadnextblog.com/QueenBeeReads. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Discover new podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatreadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you so much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.